This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, my dear friend and ex-law partner Jim Lafferty and I interview Chris Hedges about the new book that he just has come out with called Our Class, Trauma and Transformation in an American Prison. We spend the whole hour with Chris.
Yes, and it's the story of a class he taught in East Jersey State Prison with 28 students who collectively had spent 515 years in prison.
Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Stephen Smith.
And I'm Jim Lafferty, a decades-long political activist and once the national director of the National Lawyers Guild. American society is in a ever-deepening crisis. Half of the population is poor or near poor. Three men, including Jeff Bezos of Amazon, own as much as, well, all of these tens of millions of people combined. Climate catastrophe threatens life on our planet. Equally threatening is a very real potential for a nuclear war. Democracy and the rule of law are in free fall. A manifestation of this societal crisis is our system of mass incarceration. It is the largest in the world, warehousing well over 2 million people. It is, along with militarized police, the primary form of social control, essentially for poor people of color in deindustrialized cities where the poor have been abandoned and are treated little better than human refuse. Black Americans have especially suffered. They are incarcerated in state prisons at nearly five times the rate of white Americans. Nationally, 1 in 81 black adults in the U.S. is serving time in state prison. Wisconsin leads the nation in black imprisonment rates, one of every 36 black Wisconsinites in prison. In 12 states, more than half the prison population is black, largely in southern states. Seven states maintain a black-white disparity larger than 9-1. States like California, Connecticut, Minnesota, and so forth. Chris Hedges, our guest today, is taught in the college degree program offered by Rutgers University in the New Jersey prison system for over a decade now. His new book, Our Class, Trauma, and Transformation in an American Prison, is the story of a class he taught in East Jersey State Prison. His 28 students, who collectively had spent 515 years in prison, wrote a play about their lives called Caged. The process of writing the play, which was eventually performed at the Passage Theater in Trenton, New Jersey, to sold-out audiences and was published in Haymarket Books, ripped down the emotional walls most erect in prison and allowed his students to express in heartbreaking detail the trauma, grief, loss, and violence that marked their as well as the institutionally racist structures, often unseen by those on the outside, which keep the poor poor, and yet the play they wrote was at its core about radical love, the solidarity and bonds that keep them human outside and inside prison walls. Our Class, which just came out, is published by Simon & Schuster. Chris Hedges has spent two decades as a foreign correspondent, 15 of them with the New York Times covering conflicts in Central America, the Middle East, Africa, and the former Yugoslavia. He learned overseas that the evils of empire are the external expression of, well, white supremacy, just as mass incarceration, which he describes as the civil rights issue of our age, is the most brutal internal expression of white supremacy. Prison, he writes, are the modern iteration of slave plantations. Hedges is the author of 14 books, the winner of the Pulitzer Prize for Journalism, a graduate of Harvard Divinity School, and an ordained Presbyterian minister. Chris Hedges, welcome back to Law and Disorder.
Thank you, Jim.
Chris, how did the idea for your new book, Our Class, Trauma and Transformation in an American Prison, how did that come to you? What made you want to do this?
Well, I've taught in the prison system for over a decade. I've read a lot of the good works on the carceral state. I'm a writer, so I knew I wanted to write at some point, but I wanted to make a contribution that perhaps was unique or from a different angle. It was born out of this class that I taught in 2013 in East Jersey State Prison. I was teaching drama, and most of my students, I had 28 students in the class, and this is part of the BA program offered by Rutgers University to students on the inside, had very little experience with drama. And that's understandable. They're poor, they come from marginal communities where there are not theaters, they don't have $150 to go into New York and see an August Wilson play, buy a ticket for an August Wilson play. So just on a whim, I suggested that they write dramatic dialogue about their lives and their experiences to get them familiar with dramatic form, because, of course, almost everything in drama is conveyed through dialogue. And what I didn't know is that one of the students in the class was a devoted listener to WBAI, whose nickname was Kabir, which in Arabic means big, and this guy was big. And he had recruited the best writers in the prison to come to the class. So when I got home with that first set of 28 scenes, and all handwritten on lined paper with that kind of musty smell of the prison, I found, five or six that were just incredibly brilliant and lyrical and powerful. And this happened after a couple weeks, and so I realized that I wasn't the only writer in the room. It was on a whim. My wife, Eunice Wong, is an actor, and I showed them to her, and I said, I think I'm going to help them write a play. And that was the genesis of it. And in the process of writing that play, again, it was completely organic, unpremeditated. It saw them write about their trauma, their grief, their loss, their suffering, their pain, their humiliation, their search for dignity and meaning, all of these things that they don't express in a prison because of those emotional barriers that you erect in order to protect yourself in a place where to express any kind of vulnerability makes you more susceptible to becoming prey. And so as those barriers broke down, and I had their big guys, a lot of them, they call it the 400 club, it means they bench over 400 pounds, some of them covered with prison tattoos, they're up there, their hands are shaking, some of them teared up. Some of them couldn't even read it because it was too emotional. Mm-hmm. It just became this magical moment at that classroom where they shared amongst each other things they'd never, ever spoken about in the process of writing that play. And so I wasn't, when the course was done, we did write a script. Everybody had a part. Originally, I said, who wants a part? And only seven people in the class said they wanted parts. As the process went forward, all 28 people wanted parts. So we had to write 28 parts into the play, and we couldn't perform it, but Cornel West and James Cohn came in to be our audience, and I can speak about that later, a very powerful night. But the end result was that I had this script, and my goal was to get it performed, and that was a 3-year process or longer. Was, and my best writer, fortunately for me, Boris Franklin, got out, and so he and I did it together. We workshopped it in New York with Jeffrey Wise and his theater company, because we had to make it work on stage. Before, it just worked to give 28 people a part, so we had to consolidate characters and stuff. And it was eventually in 2018. So that was 5 years later, performed at the Passage Theater in Trenton, New Jersey. It was sold out every night because the horror of mass incarceration is quite familiar, unfortunately, to many people in Trenton, and then was published by Haymarket. So that was my immediate goal. Mm-hmm. And then my students started getting out. And that bonding that we had created in that classroom has remained. I mean, I'm in almost daily touch with many of them, and it fleshed out their stories, what happened to them when they were back on the outside. And it at a certain moment, it felt like now's the time to write it, but you're talking 7-8 years later.
Chris, you chose the title Our Class. Was that meant to have a double meaning?
Well, I actually chose The Class because I didn't want it to have a double meaning. The Canadian edition retains The Class, because I'm not from that class. And Simon & Schuster just felt that the more inclusive or more familiar our class, because I'm certainly present within the book, conveyed a kind of intimacy. But that was a real issue, and the Canadian Penguin Random House in Canada, I think, raised that issue, that class issue. But my preference originally was the class.
You talk, Chris, of course, in the book about the system. You believe, and we certainly agree with you, that the system isn't broken. It's not that. That, in fact, well, it functions just the way it was designed to. How does that system function and in a way that it was designed to?
So it goes back to the reconfiguration of the American economy over the last few decades, the deindustrialization of urban centers. So then you leave a large segment of the population, disproportionately people of color or poor, but not exclusively. The white, dispossessed white working class makes up much of the Trump base. And so you create what Marx calls surplus labor. These are redundant labor that is superfluous to the running of the capitalist machine. And so what you've done, to quote the sociologist Emile Durkheim, is rupture the social bonds. And when Durkheim writes his book on suicide, which was a major influence on my last book, America the Farewell Tour, that went into all the self-destructive pathologies that gripped the United States, suicide, the opioid crisis, sexual sadism, even hate groups, because Durkheim says those who seek the annihilation of others are driven by desires for self-annihilation. Durkheim says that the rupturing of those social bonds is what creates these pathologies, and I think that's right. So you've broken the social bonds, and by breaking the social bonds, these people are not integrated. They don't have a place in the society. They can't find meaning or purpose within the society. And so by integrating people into social bonds, that is a form of social control, because you're part of the mass. By thrusting them outside of the society, and forcing many of them, in order to survive, into the illegal economy, then that social control is no longer there, and that's why you replace it with militarized police forces that function as internal armies of occupation, and the largest prison system in the world, 25% of the world's prison population, and this is, you know, of course, including countries that have much larger, like China, populations than we do. We're about 4.4% or something of the world's population. So the system does function exactly the way it's designed to function, which is to use the far harsher and more coercive forms of social control through militarized police that indiscriminately use lethal force and routine acts of terror. I don't use that word lightly. In what Malcolm X called our internal colonies and mass incarceration. I mean, it's not just that most of our prison population shouldn't be there, but I think about 40% are locked up. They've never been charged with physically harming another person. But it's also that the sentences are three or four times longer than they are anywhere else in the world. So I always tell my students, I ask them, do you know how many years Gabriel Princip got for assassinating Archduke Ferdinand and his wife, the heir to the Austro-Hungarian throne? He got 20 years. I got guys in there who've got life, and they've never committed a nonviolent crime. And then, of course, the whole, it gets into the dysfunction of the court system, which is not designed to provide jury trials. It's designed to coerce people into accepting pleas. Well, how do you do that? You stack all sorts of charges against them that you can then barter with. But both the police and the prosecutors know those charges are completely bogus. Nobody pretends that those crimes are real. They're just bargaining chips. And if you don't accept the plea, and remember, they get about 15 minutes, if they're lucky, with their public attorney, then they can go to trial, but their sentences are always disproportionately longer because they have to be made an example of. Otherwise, the system would crash. The judicial system is not designed to carry out jury trials. 94% never get a trial, and that's the way the system is designed. So, but the tragedy is that the students that I teach with the longest sentences are always, almost always, the ones who went to jury trial, but they're also the ones who are almost always innocent of the crime to which they've been charged, and they naively believe that that innocence would be validated or seen in a courtroom, when, of course, the opposite is the case. they were given disproportionately long sentences to frighten everyone around them from doing the same thing.
You write that prisons are modern plantations. How so?
Well, under the 13th Amendment, as you well know, slavery is legal. So students, for instance, in New Jersey make 22 cents an hour. That's about $28 a month. And in states like Georgia and Alabama, they don't pay them anything. Prisons can't function unless prison labor is bonded, in essence, because all of the work inside the prison, with the exception of the administration and the corrections officers, is done by prisoners. You know, I used to go past the corrections officer barber shop on the way to my classroom, and there were prisoners dressed in barber uniforms. Everything is done by the prisoners. So if you paid them minimum wage, this has been the argument of the Free Alabama movement that organized prison strikes, and I think it was four prisons, and I think it lasted about 10 days, that cost the state millions of dollars. And we also have the specter of about a million people in American prisons that work for for-profit corporations. In essence, prison sweatshops, McDonald's, for instance, makes its uniforms in prison. So there you have a captive population feeding the beast of corporate capitalism for substandard wages. They don't pay into Social Security, so they can work for 40 years inside a prison and get out, and they have no Social Security at all. They're completely bereft. And then it gets us another issue, but it gets into all of the hurdles they face when they get out. They, because of their record, they can't find work. Their support system, even with their own families, if they've been in long enough, is usually disintegrated. They don't have any skills because all of the programs have been stripped, and so prisons are just warehouses. They can't get public assistance, including public housing, and they often get out of prison in debt. That's something a lot of people don't understand. They get a lot of fines when they're charged. So, for instance, one of my students, who should have never been in prison, was 14 years old. His name was Lawrence Bell. Lived in Camden, New Jersey. His father had died when he was about 2. His mother died when he was 9. He was an orphan. He was living on his own in an abandoned house in Camden, hauled into a police station and put in a room with 3 Camden City police detectives. Now, this guy's functionally illiterate. He's 90 pounds. He's 14 years old. And he's forced to sign a confession for a rape and a murder he did not commit. He goes before the judge, and he hears what is in this confession that he has supposedly agreed to, and he's appalled and attempts to protest that it's not true, and he's slapped down. Now, remember, this is a child, and he's given a sentence whereby he cannot go before a parole board. Now, that doesn't mean release. That just means requesting release until he's 70 years old. But he's also stacked with about $10,000 worth of fines. So he has no support in the prison. He's making $28 a month. Every month they're taking out $2. I can't remember exactly how much he showed me. I think it's about $2 a month. Well, when he gets out, he still owes. He got out because of a resentencing hearing that was carried out by a wonderful public defender, Jennifer Stiletti, by the grace of God. That almost never happens. And even then, we had to scramble because they wouldn't release him until he had an address, but he had no address, he had no family, so we had to raise the money to get him rent on an apartment for a year, and then my garage was filled with used furniture and kitchen stuff that other formerly incarcerated people all gathered together so he could survive, and he's one of the few, you know, success stories. He graduated summa cum laude from Rutgers when he got out, and he's now working as a community organizer. But that's an example of somebody who goes in and is released 30 years later in debt. But then you get all sorts of fines in prison, because in prison everything is privatized. We talk about private prisons. That's a problem. But the bigger problem is that all of the basic functions of a prison have been taken over by corporations. And now it's a multi-billion dollar a year industry. Global Tel Link, that's how you get fleeced for your phone service. Aramark, which has repeatedly been found to carry out mass cases of food poisoning because of the rancid food, has the food contracts. JPay is how you transfer your money. The commissary is privatized, and I got a commissary list from 1996 and looked at it today. Now, remember, they're still earning the same amount that they were then, which is about $28 a month. But all the commissary prices, and we're talking about basic items like toothpaste, you know, stuff, deodorant, had all gone up by over 100%. Medical is privatized. You go and, you know, no matter what you have, they'll give you a Motrin and add $5 to your bill. So I have one student who, I'm not going to say his name. He was actually interviewed on Law and Disorder when he got out, former Black Panther. He couldn't, he's older. He's in his late, not middle 60s, 65, 66. He's trying to work construction, and he couldn't pay the fines, and they threw him back in prison. He's now living in a, basically sleeping at the Newark train station. He doesn't want to have an address because he can't pay the money. He doesn't want to go back to prison. We have a 76% recidivism rate because most of these people can't overcome the numerous hurdles that are placed in front of them, and that's by design. I mean, the people who write the prison legislation are the lobbyists for these multi-billion dollar corporations that prey on the most vulnerable.
Going back to a bit, Chris, to the teaching experience itself, the men you taught were in a deep psychic pain. They suffered greatly. They had been traumatized. But the classroom experience, as you write about it, was, well, transformative for them. Can you talk a bit about this, please?
Well, it was transformative in that it allowed them to be who they were. It allowed mm-hmm. them to tell their own story. It allowed them to express their pain. It gave them that. It didn't change them in that sense, I suppose. What changed was their ability to speak of the pain and that they had endured and endure. And that is a huge transformation in a prison because there isn't usually a space for that in a prison. So that when that door closed, that became sacred, a sacred moment. For myself and for them. And it created bonding that, and I write in the first paragraph, a bonding that exists to this day. Something, and I you know, I've taught many times in the prison, but something happened in that classroom that has never happened anywhere else.
You appreciated your students as persons with what you call integrity. Chris, what do you mean by integrity?
Well, everything is stacked against them. And yet they rose up in the face of an indifferent universe, a hostile universe, to say, I am somebody. I am not who the wider society tells me I am. I know I'm something else. And that takes courage and integrity. You know, I'll go back to Lawrence Bell. My students, and I taught, you know, what Gramsci would call organic intellectuals. These were incredibly brilliant students who had turned their cells into libraries, highly literate, passionate about the world of ideas. And that's, of course, part of the tragedy, is that the forms of institutional racism determine that the schools that they go to, at best, give them numerical literacy to function as, a stacker in a warehouse or somebody behind a fast food counter, but don't educate them beyond the particular station that the society has allotted to them. And then to go on, and, well, I'll go back to that story with Lawrence. So I taught a history course called Conquest. We read Bury My Heart at Wounded Knee, Open Veins of Latin America, and C.L.R. James's History of the Haitian Liberation Movement, Black Jacobins. Of course, the only successful slave revolt in human history, for which Haiti has been paying for it ever since. So, and he waited. He was he's a stellar student. Always worked so hard and so conscientious and so gifted. He waited till everyone left the classroom, and he said, "I know I'm going to die in this prison, but I work as hard as I do because one day I'm going to be a teacher like you." Sometimes, you know, people ask me, "How can you keep going?" You know, I'm often accused of being bleak, although I think that's just a reflection of the bleakness around us. I said that. I mean, it doesn't mean that the system itself will be reformed or that the persecution against people I care about will halt. And yet there is a kind of triumph in that that keeps you going. And so my students who we have failed them, in spite of everything, decided to be, and I've taught in the women's prison, men and women of integrity, men and women who would not allow the forces, the oppressive forces around them, to tell them who they were. And I challenge any of your listeners to go into a prison, and remember, you're working 40 hours a week, constant noise, humiliation, you know, all of the stuff that comes with a carceral state, and get a college degree, much less graduate summa cum laude. So, I mean, these are really impressive people.
Yeah. Chris, really, with the exception of some truly sociopathic and, well, psychotic people, I frankly don't believe people belong in prison. I suspect you share that. But how do we go about altering, abolishing prisons, altering the role that prisons now play in American society?
Well, you're right. I mean, and I've taught a couple of sociopaths who are pretty creepy, but that's a mental health issue. And, of course, nobody's getting any kind of mental health services. So 25% of the prison population has severe psychological problems. And the way they do it is they drug them up. They turn them into zombies. And people who are literate, like my students, they're terrified of being put on that drug regime because they physically deteriorate. First of all, they just sleep all day. So they induce this chemical lethargy, but then they like get the shakes and they can't remember, and that's how, courtesy of Ronald Reagan in particular, that's how we deal with our mentally ill. In the short term, I think we have to listen to those who are incarcerated because they know, and it isn't by writing letters to our congresspeople. Those who have organized the prison strikes in states like Alabama, Texas, California, argue that forcing prisons to pay minimum wage will have the most immediate effect of reducing the prison population, because economically the carceral state will no longer be sustainable at the levels that it's at. That's the short term. And I'm a great believer that we listen to them. We don't tell them. They know better than we do. And that's what they say. And then, of course, the wider issue is we have to dismantle this ruthless structure of oligarchic, predatory corporate capitalism, because it is now what was begun as an assault against poor people of color, largely in urban centers, is now spread to the white working class, with all of the distortions that poverty, which is, as George Bernard Shaw correctly points out, the greatest of all crimes, with all of this distortions and the rupturing of the social bonds and the dark pathologies that come with the destruction of those social bonds now visited on the society. And the failure of the Biden administration to understand the depth of the crisis and continue to dance to the tune of their corporate donors means that next time around, we're going to get Trump or somebody even worse than Trump. But this time around, their entire agenda will be vengeance. And so it is most of my writing tends to focus on these underlying forces that have distorted and destroyed the institutions and the mechanisms by which we could create a capitalist democracy. So we're in very, very, very deep crisis. And if we don't address that crisis, not only will the carceral state not go away, but the revoking of the most basic civil liberties that is common in poor communities, especially urban communities, disproportionately black and brown, will be visited on the rest of us. That's the eradication of due process. I mean, your show has done a good job of this, but the whole corrosion of the most basic forms of legal protections against the citizenry are almost already gone. But with a flick of a switch, we've really empowered a despotic state to very quickly create a kind of corporate tyranny. And we're already very far along.
I want to remind our audience that we are talking with Chris Hedges, who just had his book, Our Class, Trauma and Transformation in an American Prison, published by Simon & Schuster. It's a wonderful book, and I encourage our listeners to go out and get it. Chris, Was the enormous increase in imprisoning black people in the 1970s in response to the civil rights movement the decade before, was that why they did it?
Yes, and the prison uprising in places like Attica. So Heather Ann Thompson writes a very fine book, Blood in the Water, that talks about that. And what's fascinating was, and the book is really brilliant and just a tremendous piece of history. What was fascinating was watching the internal reaction of Nixon and Rockefeller on the inside, who thought that this was the start of a Maoist rebellion. It shows you how frightened they were. And as Thompson points out in the book, they used that, the Black Power movement, they used the prison uprisings like Attica to really not only effectively demonize black people, but justify the building of this massive carceral state. Now, in the play that we wrote, I wanted a character who represented that old generation of black radicals. And so I went and interviewed Audrey Lotulo in Newark, who was a member of the Black Liberation Army, was arrested. He held up a bank in Newark. He didn't kill any policemen, but he was in a shootout with them. I asked him how he felt. He said, "I felt like the freest black man in America." So Audrey is this, you know, this old style, you know, like Mumia. I mean, just so well read, so thoughtful. But I wanted that character, and so I interviewed him for about 6 hours, and then typed up the transcripts and brought them back into the classroom, so he would represent that older generation. But when Audrey was arrested and thrown into the prison in Trenton, he immediately went into solitary confinement. He'd never committed a deletion in the prison, but they were terrified of him preaching revolution and raising the consciousness of the rest of the prison population. And we forget that the reinstitution of solitary confinement was created for black radicals to segregate them from the population. He spent 22 years in isolation. But even then, he resisted. He refused to wear the prison uniform. They would put snitches on the tier. Fires would mysteriously erupt in their cells until there were no snitches on the tier. The runners, the people who carry the messages and food and stuff for the guards, he said, "Stop doing that. That's the job of the guards." Even then, and he made these beautiful, powerful collages of kind of radical art. Which several of which he gave me, he was an important figure to put in because, yes, the expansion of the prison population began as a response to the Black Power movement and to the organizing of black radicals, but then was turbocharged with deindustrialization and the need to find coercive forms of control to keep abandoned populations in check.
And you know, Chris, you point out that the mass incarceration was a response to the civil rights movement of the late 60s and 70s. And the same token, you write and describe that that now the civil rights issue is that mass incarceration.
I think there are many civil rights issues, but well, I would say mass incarceration is the most important because it is essentially stripped. If it's found a mechanism to remove any kind of cohesiveness or leadership within especially black communities by locking up black men. And what you do is you lock up the men and you evict the women and children. The women and children fall into economic freefall. It's migratory. They're constantly being pushed from place to place. So most of my students don't even finish 1 year in a school. They're constantly the disruption in their lives, and also the trauma of evictions. They talk about it. It's part of the play. They write about the evictions, the people showing up and throwing all their furniture on the street, and they have nowhere to go, and they end up in an abandoned house, and there's no electricity, and there's drug activity in the house. I mean, that is a constant in their life. And if you constantly evict people and you remove the male population from a community, you can't build any kind of cohesiveness. You can't build any kind of organization to resist, and I don't think that's accidental.
Chris, you have a quote in your book, Our Class, from the extraordinary revolutionary leader, Ojeri Atulu. And I wondered whether you might read that for our listening audience, please.
Sure. This was integrated into the play, and it was pretty much taken from the transcript, from the taped interview I did with Ojeri outside the prison. And he represents this historical consciousness. So this is what he says. "The state created the hole for us revolutionaries back in the day. They had to keep us from the rest of the population, and they had to break us. They couldn't let us preach resistance. They refined all their torture techniques in the 60s on the Panthers, the Black Liberation Army, the Puerto Rican Independence Movement, and the American Indian Movement. Today they add Islamic militants, jailhouse lawyers, gangbangers, and political prisoners to the list, but they hate us the most. We know what they don't want you to know. We know the control of black bodies been seamless, from slavery to black codes to convict leasing to the Jim Crow laws to the so-called war on drugs. We know promotions, quotas, money from the feds, the money they take off of us is what makes prison a business. A body ain't worth nothing on the street, but once inside, once you locked in a cage, you worth $50,000 a year to all them prison contractors, food service companies, phone companies, medical companies, and prison construction companies, and they got to keep them cages full if they're going to make their money. And once you get out, once you've done your time, they make sure you got no job, no food stamps, no public housing, so you end up right back in where you can make them some more money. People say the system don't work. That's because they don't get it. The system works just the way it's designed to work. Inside, you meant to be a slave. You forced to work for a dollar a day. You call the New Jersey Bureau of Tourism and you're talking to a prisoner at the Edna Mahan Correctional Institute for Women who's making 23 cents an hour. No ability to negotiate wages, working hours, or working conditions. And the state don't want that kind of consciousness. The state knows the power of ideas, but I don't ask them what's fair or not fair. They want to destroy us. We want to destroy them. Fair has nothing to do with it. We still got hundreds of black revolutionaries, our prisoners of war, our political prisoners in cages all across North America. Mumia Abu-Jamal, Sundiata Akoli, Mutulu Shakur, Imam Jamil Alameen, Jalil Abdul Muntakim, Sekou Ondega, Abdul Majid, Tom Manning, Bill Dunn, and Leonard Peltier. Almost no one remembers we exist. The state done erased our memory, but we survive even in here because we have a purpose. We know our history, which means the history and persecution of our people. We got a community even inside these walls. We got the spiritual and physical strength to face captivity and death, and that means we always free."
Based on all that we've heard from you today, it leads me to this question. I don't know, several decades ago, 30, 40 years ago, there were, 300,000 people in our prison system. Now there are 2.3 million. People often, I think, miss a fact I'd like to ask you about, and that is, talk to us a bit about the role of the Democratic Party, and for that matter, specifically Biden, in accomplishing this massive, massive implosion of prisoners.
So that's right. About 1970, we had about 300,000 people in the prison system. And the Clinton administration decided that they would take back the law and order issue from the Republicans. This was part of the Clinton's transformation of the Democratic Party into the Republican Party. And then, of course, they pushed the Republican Party so far to the right it became insane. And Biden was at the forefront of this, and Naomi Murakawa writes a good book on this, First Civil Right, I think it's called, where she documents all this. So they're trying to out-Republican the Republicans, so that especially the 1994 Omnibus Crime Bill, becomes the mechanism by which they, during the Clinton administration alone, almost double the prison population. That's where you get the three strikes, your outlaws. So what country in the world sends people to life for drugs? that's where you get the tripling or quadrupling of sentences, which we've already spoken about. So they're three or four times longer than they are anywhere else in the world for the same crime. That's where you get the assault, the breakdown of the court system, so people no longer get jury trials. Biden at the time was bragging about how he expanded federal crimes for the death penalty. I believe there was just a handful, one or two,
yeah.
You may know. And by the time he's done, I think there's 51 for death penalties. And he was this was part of his campaign rhetoric. Mm-hmm. So it was the Democrats. I mean, the Republicans colluded, but it was the worst assault was done under Clinton. That's why I can't vote for Biden. That's why I don't, half of my students or more would not be in that classroom but for Biden and Clinton.
Chris Hedges, no nation has the right to call itself a democracy if it does not follow and does not allow a free independent press, including a press that is free to investigate and publish facts that the nation would rather never see the light of day. But that's exactly what America continues to do with regard to Julian Assange, who exposed the multiple U.S. war crimes by the U.S. in Iraq and Afghanistan, corruption of the democratic process with Hillary Clinton. He was prosecuted initially by Trump. Now we know that in addition to Trump plotting with the head of the CIA, Mike Pompeo, to assassinate Assange, the Biden administration continues to persecute and prosecute him. Your thoughts on this matter and how free our press is today and what the Assange case tells us about what are supposedly our freedoms?
The Biden administration, remember the Obama administration did not go after Assange because, quite correctly, legally, if they went after Julian, they would have to go after the New York Times since they published the Iraqi war logs, other stuff that WikiLeaks released. But I think it was 2017, was Vault 7, that was WikiLeaks' release that exposed the ability of the CIA through hacking tools to get into our just everything, our cars, our phones, or even our smart TVs. And the CIA went ballistic. Pompeo was the head of the CIA then. That changed the equation. The deep state, if we want to call it that, certainly the intelligence community is determined to get Julian. And Biden, of course, Biden was selected by the oligarchic and corporate elite for precisely this purpose. He's been doing their bidding for 40-plus years, as used to be nicknamed Senator Credit Card, because he served the interests of the credit card companies that were headquartered in Delaware, far beyond the his constituents. Of course, they again employed his son Hunter at lavish salaries. So I was in London for some of the hearings. Judge Baritzer didn't dispute, although I think legally it's not justifiable. And I used to go over and visit Julian with Michael Ratner. But the judge, there was just incontrovertible evidence, including the discovery of a razor hidden under his socks and the fact that from Belmarsh High Security Prison he was calling the Samaritans, talking about that he had suicidal thoughts hundreds of times a day, that he was banging his head against the walls of his cell, that he was pounding his head with his fist, that he was frantically pacing the cell until he collapsed, and they had to move him into a medical unit. I mean, so there wasn't any question in that hearing he was psychologically distressed, and then given, again, the conditions of the American prison system, there wasn't much he could do. It was pretty clear that put into isolation, which alone will drive you insane, you can go in quite healthy psychologically. And then SAMS, the special administrative measures that would be used against him. It was interesting in the appeal, they kept trying to assure the court, well, I listened to it by video link, all of it, for the 2 days, that they wouldn't use SAMS. But there's no, of course they'll use SAMS, and they've turned it over to Kronberg, who's kind of the grand inquisitor for the national security state in Virginia, and a nut in and of his own right. I won't get into Kronberg. But so they appealed it, and they attempted to argue. I mean, it was kind of almost farcical. They were talking about all the wonderful activities they have in Florence, Colorado. And my favorite was they can crochet, and that Julian would be able to exercise individually. That's a euphemism for exercising alone in a cage for an hour every day or every other day. So that's where we are. The ruling is expected on the appeal in January sometime. We don't know yet. If they uphold the ruling, then they can appeal to the Supreme Court. I think either way you'll see appeals. But the Biden administration, after Vault 7, is not giving up on this.
The 26th climate conference, attended by leaders of the world's nations, is just concluded, or is wrapping up as we speak. Does it appear to you that sufficient progress on slowing or halting climate change was made at this conference? And do you believe, in fact, that, well, meaningful progress on curbing climate change can ever be made so long as we live in a essentially capitalist world?
No, and I think statistically that's been well proven. Carbon emissions over the last few decades have steadily increased. Temperatures are rising. The effects of the climate crisis are palpable to whether it's wildfires and forest fires and droughts in the Southwest and monster hurricanes. But the capitalist system has only two goals, and that's increasing profit and reducing the cost of production. Let's go back to our Marx. That's it. They don't. These are very myopic, short-sighted, greedy, self-obsessed entities. To challenge the structure that is in place that creates the fossil fuel industry that perpetuates modern industrial society and their position and their wealth within that society, is it's never going to happen. So the only hope we have is, I think Extinction Rebellion has got it correctly, is mass resistance to bring that system down, because the system itself is incapable of reform, and it has amply proven it with, you know, whether this latest COP conference or all the ones before it or the ones that are going to come after it. We have an expression in Arabic called kalam fadi, which means empty talk. That's what they're good at. I mean, you have two options. One, don't worry, we're taking care of it through non-binding agreements. And I wrote a book with Joe Sacco a couple years ago called Days of Destruction, Days of Revolt. And we went to the sacrifice zones, those places that capitalism has already sacrificed, like the coal fields of southern West Virginia. Well, everybody should take a tour, because they don't stop until it's a giant wasteland with billion-gallon ponds of toxic, carcinogenic materials and blown-off mountaintops. I mean, there are hollows in West Virginia where you turn on the tap and what comes out are fumes that can light on fire. Cancer is an epidemic. Every 2 hours we had to stop the Jeep we were in and use Windex because all the windows were black. You went into the elementary schools, the nurse's office, and there were rows of little inhalers with the names of each student on them. They won't stop till then. And that was the point of that book, to say you better look, because now we've become one giant sacrifice zone. And what they have done to farm workers, and we were with Immokalee, that great farm workers union. We interviewed workers who were from Honduras. They were undocumented. They were chained in the trucks at night, with slavery. And they were told that if they reported it to authorities, their families back in Honduras or Guatemala would be killed. And they had the names and addresses of the families. That's where capitalism goes. And again, you can see what it does within the prison system. The weaker you become, the more vulnerable you become, the more they exploit. They're completely predatory. And the whole point of deregulation is to strip away what few safeguards we have from these predatory entities. And that's, it ties completely into the climate crisis. So if you want to know what will happen to us if these systems are not dismantled, take a trip to southern West Virginia. It's pretty appalling. The tops of the mountains are blown off. You know, everybody's having gallbladder surgery. It's apocalyptic. And that's the future if it's not wrested from their hands.
because there are examples of that that you could cite about what's going on in many countries of the world. You already have millions of people who have been displaced because of climate change, and we're already living in it. It's the global South,
which is did not cause the problem, that first pay the price. Well, that's another gift of imperialism.
Indeed it is. Mike?
Chris Hedges, before we run out of our allotted time, I wanted you to remind our listeners on how people can follow your work.
After we all got fired from Truthdig for protesting the attempt by the publisher to fire Bob Scheer and then demanding the right to form a union, imagine that.
Oh, my goodness.
We all went to Scheer Post, where we're not making any money, but it's a free space. So Scheer Post, and then I have a show called On Contact on RT America, where I interview writers and dissidents. Just interviewed Glenn Greenwald about, and that's a good show, about what the kind of violation of the civil liberties that are being used against the people who carried out the mob attack on January 6th. So, yeah, and then, of course, my book, Our Class.
Yeah.
And there is a Twitter account, Chris Lynn Hedges. I don't run it, but keeps current. It posts interviews and articles that I've written and interviews on the program that I've carried out.
Sounds like most of the day you're just kind of sitting around your backyard, I don't know, enjoying the good life. Yeah, you got to work harder, Chris. Come on.
Yeah.
Please, any last thoughts you'd like to leave our audience with?
I guess my concern is the left and where it spends its energy and time, which is often attacking each other, you know, embracing this kind of moral purity, which coming out of the church I find pretty repugnant, that we have to keep focused on who the enemy is and the lethal forces that are control our lives. And so I'm all for the kind of inclusiveness, of course, and consideration and sensitivity that many in the woke culture embrace, but I think too often that internecine warfare deflects our energy from where it should be focused, and that's against a ruling corporate power, the oligarchic elite, the money-saturated electoral process that produces politicians that essentially serve the interests of lobbyists, the war industry. We forget, you know, we're never going to have an equitable, and I'm a socialist, you know, an equitable state until we dismantle what Karl Liebknecht on the eve of World War I called the enemy from within, and that is militarism. Martin Luther King, of course, highlighted that in his 1967 speech at Riverside Church. But I think oftentimes, you know, one of my frustrations with Bernie Sanders is that he never mentioned this issue. Well, we're never going to recreate society unless we dismantle this military machine, which is disemboweling the country from the inside. And as someone who has studied, I studied classics at Harvard, somebody who studied the fall of the Roman Empire, the Greek Empire, I mean, Thucydides got this, that the expansion of empire, Thucydides write, the tyranny that Athens imposed on others it finally imposed on itself. And the creation of a centralized power destroyed the Greek demos, in essence destroyed their democracy and created tyranny. We're no different. I mean, we will replicate with our own modern variations the collapse of other empires with all of the attendant problems that come with it, unless we become very proactive. So my closing thought is just remember who it is we're fighting, which doesn't mean that we shouldn't be sensitive. We should to, you know, all sorts of people who have, you know, different religious traditions or gender traditions or orientations or race or anything else. But let's keep our eye where it needs to be focused, and that's on companies like Chevron that just imprisoned my friend, the great human rights lawyer, Stephen Donziger.
Jim Lafferty and I would like to thank you very much for being on our show, Law and Disorder. You've written a book that we hope Everybody that can listen to this program will go out and get it. It's called Our Class, Trauma and Transformation in an American Prison. It's a really profound book, Chris. We're grateful that you did what you did in getting it out. And we thank you for being on the show.
Yes, take it easy.
Yes, thank you, Michael.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org. That's lawanddisorder.org. One word, lawanddisorder.org. Mm-hmm.